A short coffee and cake break.
Well, I would like to introduce our main speaker for the evening. Please give a warm welcome to Jerry from San Diego.
All right. Get my crib notes. I'm Jerry Stump, an alcoholic. And as I said, my sobriety date is May 10th, 1974. I want everybody to know about that in case we start a retirement plan. You never know. You're getting a lot of money up there in New York, you know. Before I get into my story, a couple things I'd like to share with you. How many people ever heard of Milt Giverson? Got to be careful. You get my age, you hate to see anything shaped like that drooping. You know what I mean? My drug of choice used to be alcohol. Now it's Viagra. No, it's not for what you think. You know, I was peeing on my shoes all the time when I had to start. But anyway, that's another story. I'd ask you if you knew Milt before I get into the thing. We got a little thing going here. Milt, as most of you know, was either the founder or co-founder. I've never decided understood which of the South Bay Pioneers. And on my 30th anniversary, Milt died at 44 years sober. On my 30th anniversary, his wife, Florine, got his 30-year token out. And I was privileged to carry that for my 30th year. And we kind of made a little memorial thing out of it. I kept it for a couple years after that. And then another man who's in the room, Gary here, turned 30. He knew him, and he carried it for his 30th anniversary. And we have another man waiting in the wings. He's 8 months away from his 30th birthday. And the whole idea of this thing, God, I'm sorry, I really am sorry.
What do you have against Mike?
Yeah, right. I'm trying to make it droop. Anyway, that token will pass down to the people that knew him in memory of him. And that's the only requisite is, did you know him? And if the answer is yes and you're coming up on 30, then that token would be available. And that's what we're going to do. Having said that, one of my heroes in this room, Mr. Bob Moeller, I'll break his anonymity, it's okay, got his 35-year token out for me. And I'm carrying that token now. And we will pass that down and also that Bob will never be forgotten on this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Just a little thing we got going, has nothing to do with what I'm going to talk about tonight. Anyway, I was raised on the mean streets of Los Angeles. My mother was a prostitute. It was during the Depression. There was no jobs. There's nothing to do. My mother and father divorced when I was a year old. He had a little horse ranch in Tucson, Arizona. And my mother and I being the youngest of four, she got custody of me and we went to Los Angeles. And as I said, I was raised on the mean streets of Los Angeles. I was raised with the prostitutes, the pimps, the ex-cons, dope pushers. That was the society. That was the people who influenced my young years, you know. I knew far too much when I was 6, 7, 8 years old. I knew stuff that I had no business knowing about, but it was by nature of the way I was raised. just kind of give you a little story. I was going to the Norwood State School. I didn't got there yet. I will get to a state school, I promise. Two of them. I was going to Norwood Street School over there, and a group had come in from a high school nearby. I think I was 7, 8 years old. And they said that they was going to put on a demonstration for us. They was going to show us gymnastics and tumbling and a lot of other tricks. I didn't know what gymnastics were. I didn't know what tumbling was. I knew what tricks were. I knew exactly what tricks were. I said, damn, I don't want to miss that show. I want to find out where that, what high school that is, and that's where I'm going. So, like I said, I knew too much, way too much, far too much than I should have known, you know. There's a lot of hatred in me at that time. There was a lot of hatred. I hated everybody around me, everything around me. I hated my mother. I hated the lifestyle we lived. I hated the things that we'd done and the way we lived. And I grew up with that. When I was 13 years old, there's a man assaulting my mother. I picked up a pair of scissors, stabbed that man, and he bled out and bled to death. So at 13 years old, I'd taken my first life and didn't care. I remember sitting on a couch with a detective with a handcuffs, and he was holding the handcuffs. And he asked me, what are you feeling? And I looked at him like he was nuts. I said, I ain't feeling nothing, you know. And he said, well, are you sorry? I said, sorry for what? The guy was hurting my mother. And that was the anger and the terrible, terrible feelings that were inside me. I just didn't care, you know. I just didn't care. As a result of that, I was sent to what was then called Whittier State School for Boys. That's up in Whittier, California. It's now called Fred C. Nellis School for Boys. They changed the name. And I went up there, and I was incorrigible. I went up there with that chip on my shoulder. I didn't care. I really, honestly, at that time, thought I had no fear of anything. I feared nothing. And when I was in an altercation with another person, it's like everything slowed down. Everything went slow motion. I knew exactly what I had to do, enjoyed what I was doing, and I was incorrigible, and I was a loner, and I was all these things. And as a result of that, I just couldn't get along, didn't want to get along. And I went to what was then Preston School of Industries. It's now called Ione School of Industries. You're familiar with that, are you? And so I graduated up to that. There was a guy in there, some of the people in, there's very few in my age bracket here, huh? But you may remember a guy by the name of Carol Chessman. He was called the Red Light Bandit. That guy was innocent of what he was convicted for. Spent the longest time on death row than anybody, and was finally executed. I remember I'd just come out of isolation up there. We was at Preston, and he was at the athletic field. And I, for whatever reason, he come over and he said to me, he said, you know, why do you keep fighting these people? And because their ladies were present, I won't tell you what I said. I've really tried to clean up my language here in the last 35 years. But he says, you know, once you're in custody, he says, and he used this analogy. He says, you got to bend like the oak. You know, the oak tree will bend with the wind. It won't stiffen and break. And he says, well, you're stiffen and break. You can't beat these people once you're in custody. You know? Do you guys know anything about custody? and you know, that was good advice. It was good advice. And I started doing things differently to run forward into my... In January of 1950, I stood before a judge named Roger Alton Pfaff in Los Angeles. You know him? And he gave me a choice. Before that, I'd done an 18-month hitch in the Army, and I was before him for a very severe assault on another human being. And he says, you're either going back in the Army or you're going to San Quentin. And I'll let you know which that's going to be after court's over. And I sat and waited. And I, as it turned out, it went his decision that if I would go back in the Army, there'd be no further prosecution. So I did. I went back in the Army. And he told me I had to go to the back end. He didn't tell me I had to stay. So the Korean War broke out June 25th of 1950, and they let me out of the stockade before I could go over to Korea. It broke out June 25th, and I got there July 26th, a month and a day later, and I remember it because July 26th happened to be my mother's birthday. Right? During all this time, the alcohol had started. And, you know, alcohol was doing much more for me than it was doing to me. And it was, you know, I could be anything that I wanted to be with the alcohol. You know, I played so, there's so many facades and this and that and all this stuff, you know. So there was alcohol involved. I hadn't mentioned that. Anyway, I went to Korea. I was in Korea a year and 8 days, and they started promoting me and decorating me for the things they kept locking my ass up for back here. You know, and I figured, hey man, I got this figured out. I'm just living on the wrong side of the ocean. That's all. You know? So, truth be told, I done quite well. I come back a master sergeant in that year and 8 days. Just by process of elimination, actually, and decided to make the Army my career. And to summarize for you, at one time I was the youngest master sergeant in my division. And at the end of my career, I screwed it up. I think I was the oldest private in the same division. Not quite sure of that, but I think I was. You know. But anyway, the alcohol. It was the alcohol that screwed it up. You know, and I've said many times that I wished I could say, well, I was 9 years, 3 months, and 14 days when I had my first. I don't know. I don't remember when I had the first drink. It was just always there, you know. I remember my first sexual experience. Maybe I ought to share that with you, huh? I don't remember my first taco, but I remember that. The thing that I remember, there's only three things, actually, that I remember about that. Is number one, I was about 13 years old. I was just scared to death, frightened. And I was by myself. You know, I'm kidding. I'm a lot of the people that know me, and I got to tell the truth because there's too damn many people in here that know me, know my story, you know. But where was I going with that?
In Korea.
I ain't got back yet.
Private.
Anyway, for alcohol, I screwed up the career in the Army, you know, had an opportunity to get out and got out and come back. You know, maybe you guys can identify with this. It's so common with us that we are so self-destructive when we're into our disease of alcoholism. We are so, self-destructive, you know. I like to liken it to my life, the rebirths that I've had. I like to liken it to the mythical bird, the phoenix. The phoenix would rise from its own ashes and grow into this beautiful plumage. And it'd grow and grow and grow. Get too close to the sun and it'd burst into flames and it'd be reduced down to that pile of ashes again. And that epitomizes my life. It really does. You know, I had the successes and I had the extreme failures. You know, and I got out of the Army and I got a job with the General Motors Manpower Development Program. How in the world I ever managed that, I'll never know. My counterpart at Ford at that time, that was before he went to Chrysler, was Lee Iacocca. And we were doing the same thing for different firms. I was in the manpower development. He was in manpower for General Motors. And he was in manpower development for Ford. And, of course, his claim to fame is the in 1964, he came out with that with the Mustang. And that made the Ford Motor Company and made him, really. But, you know, I was a fair-haired boy. I was the great car man. I was this, I was that, blah, 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 all this stuff. But I knew that someday they're going to find out about me. They're going to find out that I couldn't control my drinking. I knew that they was going to say, what's all this bar tab, you know, because I traveled a lot. And, you know, they never did. But I knew that one day they would. One day they knew that they would find out that I took a man's life prior to puberty, for God's sake. And I knew that once they did, they found that out, they would ask me to leave. So the self-fulfilling prophecy there was to quit and go do something else. And that was a pattern in my life. Full-blown into my alcoholism. You know, that was the pattern. I'd done the same thing in marriages. Honest to God. I was married to this lady. We're still best of friends. In Tucson, Arizona, she never knew about me. She never knew about the history before. We had three kids. And I knew that one day she was going to find out about all these things and tell me, you can't be here. You can't be the father of these kids. I don't want to. And you know what? I left. Come to San Diego. Walked away. Because alcoholism. You know? And you know that, I can go on and on and on. There's story after story after story. As you have them. You know? As you have those stories. On May 10th of 1974, as I said, I woke up and I realized that I was utterly and totally defeated by the use of alcohol. I couldn't do this anymore. I had had contact with Alcoholics Anonymous in 1956. A commanding officer had sent me to meetings for 30 days. And I remember they were 2 hours long. It's terrible. I used to go to the NCO club, see how drunk I could get. And then I'd sit in the back of the room with my sunglasses on, with my arms crossed, which I lovingly refer to as my throne of contempt. You know, what am I doing with these people? You know, just because they can't drink, they got me in here, blah, blah, blah. You know, I'm a victim. I'm victimized again, you know. But on May 10th, I knew what to do. I knew where the solutions were, and I called central office. And May 10th of 1974 was on a Saturday. It happened to be the day before Mother's Day. And they asked me if I wanted someone to come out, do this, to come out and talk to me. And I said, no, not really. Where is there some place I can go? What can I do? And they said, well, you live in East County. There's an Alano Club over on Washington Boulevard, 834 Washington Boulevard, I think it was. And you can go over there. There'll always be someone there to talk to you, you know. Which I did. Just to show you the insanity at the time. I took my 7-year-old boy, he's 43, 42 now. I took him with me, And this is the insanity of my alcoholism at the time. I'm thinking, if I got my boy Tim with me, I won't drink. But if I do, I won't get drunk. But if I do get drunk, I probably won't drive. But if I do, I'll be very careful. And I'm the guy that had trouble with the second step, okay? The insanity of that thought process, you know. And I went over there to the club, and there's a guy by the name of Jay Roberts there. And he talked. We come in, and we sat down, and this guy talked. And he talked. And he talked. Then he talked some more. And man, oh man, I'm dry. I'm dry, honest to God. I could have taken a match, scratched it on my tongue. It would have lit. I was dry. I needed a drink. All I could think of was get away from this guy, you know. I don't know how long it was. It seemed an eternity, a couple hours anyway, you know. And I told him, well, listen, I got to get my little boy home here and blah, 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 blah. And he said, well, I'm going to ask you to do two favors for me. I want two promises from you. And I said, yeah, what's that? And he says, would you come back tonight? We're going to have a meeting here at 8 o'clock. He says, if you'll come early, I'll meet you at the door. I'll introduce you around, and we'll get you started here. I said, okay, I promise. And he says, the second thing, I ask that you promise me that you won't take a drink between now and that meeting. I said, yeah, you bet, I promise. You bet. You know, and I believe that it was at that time it was God's intercession. I really do, because I kept that promise, and I haven't had a drink since that day. And I showed up at that thing, and I did what he asked me. I come early, and here's these people in this great big room. And they're laughing and joking and hugging and kissing each other, waving across the room. And I asked him, I said, for God's sakes, how long has it been since these people seen each other? And he said, well, most of them was here last night, you know. And you know, I can honestly say I fell in love with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous right there. And I'd like to stand up here tonight and tell you that, man, like a grease sled or something, I got right into this, blah, blah, blah. And that would be a lie. Because, you know, the egotism and I thought that that book was written for the great unwashed masses. That didn't pertain to me. I was educated, you know. I could still think my way through all this stuff, but you needed this. What's the height of egotism? You know, thank God that isn't in my life today. Thank God that that's not there. And I thank him because that's where it went. He took it away because I asked for it, you know. But I started this adventure called sobriety then. And the wonderful, lovely, lovely people that I've met. And there's a lot of people in this room. They're sitting there, over here, back there, there. A number of people in this room that I can say, these people are my hero. Heroes. They are. They, if you would, blaze this trail ahead for me, you know? And you know, if you're not having fun in sobriety, I have a lot of fun in sobriety. I really do. You know, someone told me early on that laughter was the music of the soul. And I really totally believe that. I remember, I got to share this with you, I was asked to speak at the Live and Let Live Club. It's for gay people. And I had a stepson, 19 years sober, that was very active in that club. And they asked me to speak there. You know, well, I've been a card-carrying member of the heterosexual community all my life. And I'm thinking, what am I going to say? What am I going to talk to these people? And I really meditated on that, you know. And I'm thinking, you know, I love women. I love everything there is about a woman. I love the way they walk. I love the way they talk, the way they giggle, the way they wiggle, the way they smell, the way they taste. I love everything about them. and I'm looking for the common thread. And it come to me. You're probably a lesbian trapped in a man's body. And you know what? I went and told those people that when I spoke there, and it cracked them up. Because you could kind of feel the resistance there. You know, when I say those people are we people. They're the same as me and you and everybody else in this room. Because we're like a pearl necklace. We're strung together one bead at a time, one alcoholic at a time, for a common goal. And that's what I have in common with them. It has nothing to do with mine or their sexual proclivity. It has to do with we share a common bond and we're yoked in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all I needed to know. But it's fun to laugh. You know, it's fun to make people laugh. And what I've tried to do in my sobriety is carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. What Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me, it's allowed me to become the man that I've always wanted to be. I stand before you, all one piece of what I wanted to be. And there's people in this room that's made this transition with me. My friend Craig back there, done a lot of time together, done a lot of wailing and moaning and gnashing of teeth. We've done a lot of laughing, a lot of crying together. And he's seen the metamorphosis. And the metamorphosis is not me, it's what you did. It's what you people can do with a sick, drunk alcoholic. And that's what you've done for me. You know, I have been so blessed in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. People kid me about being married so many times, you know. And what are you laughing at? I was a self-appointed chairman of the Alcoholics Anonymous Matrimonial Catch and Release Program. But 25 years ago about, God blessed me with my wife, Julie. And we've been together, joined at the hip for nearly those 25 years. And you know what? It's been such a joy that, number one, I found the relationship that I looked for all my life through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. She is not my sponsor, nor I hers. We stay totally out of those areas, you know. But, you know, the thing that we've been complimented on is people who want to start a relationship or want to start a marriage have talked to us. How do you do it? How do you do it? And we've been blessed in that we can say we stay out of one another's program. You know, unless I ask a specific question, she makes no comments. She does say from time to time, have you talked to your sponsor lately? you know, one of the blessings of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has been my wife, Julie. I got what I looked for. Oh, God. I'd put that in my pocket, but I won't. Anyway. And this is what we have in this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we have a legacy, and Julie asked me not to say this, and we'll say it anyway. We have a legacy to, you know, I'm 80 years old. I grew up and grew old in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 45 when I got sober, and I'm 80 years old now. I'm 35 years sober. My only regret is I can't do another 35 years. It's highly improbable, right? But I can take this legacy of sobriety and pass on to you and challenge you to...
What you've got against me?
I can take this legacy of sobriety and challenge you. You people that are out there that's beginning into this thing. Maybe you haven't hit double digits yet. It doesn't make any difference. the legacy goes to you. You know, there's going to be a day when I'm not sitting in one of these chairs, and Bobby's going to be gone, and Ski's going to be gone, and Roger's going to be, and these guys, we're going to be gone. And the legacy passes to you, you know. And my hope for that would be that you don't allow this program to become diluted.
Yes, sir.
You know, don't let the program become diluted. We've got the only, one of the few successful programs in the 12-step conglomerate of programs. The most successful is Alcoholics Anonymous. And why? Because we have 12 steps, but more importantly, we have the 12 traditions. And that legacy I pass on to you. You know, this, as I said in the beginning up here, the 35 years is not mine, it's yours. The 35 years is a legacy of a wonderful program that will allow us to become the people that we've always wanted to be. Thank you for letting me share.
Thank you.